So, good evening. I'm Tatiana Bazzichelli, the director of the Disruption Network Club, and I'm happy to introduce the seventh episode of our Disruptive Friday. And today we speak about whistleblowing and COVID-19. Together with me, there is Renata Avila, that is the executive director of Ciudadanía Inteligente. We have Joseph Farrell, the WikiLeaks ambassador. Rimas Geyer from the Outreach and Research Fellow Hermes Center for Transparency and Digital Human Rights. She is also active in the Digital Whistleblowing Fund. So I want to thank all of them for being with us. Unfortunately, Annegret Falter, that was supposed to moderate with me, had something unexpected, and she cannot be with us. But questions that also she sent us, and there will be possible to have her here even if she's not present. I also want to thank Elena Velianoska that works with us on the production, and Ranav Adhikari from the Boiling Head Media that is the person that is creating all this streaming technique for us. So thank you, everybody. And first of all, I want to thanks also our audience that is following us on the chat. I want to tell everybody that you could pose questions, you could interact with us. So please feel free to also share the projects that you are doing. We have a person from our team that is answering to you. And at the end of the session, we will have also the questions sent to us and to our speakers. I want to introduce the topic of today, saying that some weeks ago, a coalition of public institutions and authorities and NGOs were called together to sign a letter. And this letter was something very important that was done to advocate for protection of whistleblowers. It was a letter that was and also FIBGAR, and was signed by 95 NGOs. And this is something very important to point out because we know that whistleblowers are people at risk because they expose misconducts and wrongdoings. They do this during time of crisis, but they also do it during the everyday life of everybody. So we should always think on how to protect them, and most of all, also in times like the one that we're experiencing today, especially because we need whistleblowers when we speak about corruption, abuses of power, and this could happen on the health systems, on the different work environments, on the commercial and delivery markets, but could also happen in the larger scale when we speak about technology tracking and surveillance. So we know that whistleblowers operate in very different fields, and not only regionally or in different countries, but also globally. That is why this letter was crucial and very important to address this subject that's us all during this global pandemic. Today, I would like also to give first the word to our speakers to introduce what they're doing because we want to speak about whistleblowing during these times, but they have been all working with the subject of whistleblowing for many years. Before entering into the specific topic of the crisis, also I would like to ask to introduce themselves briefly and tell us what are they working on at the moment, and briefly describe in which way they are also supporting whistleblowers with their work. So we start with Renata first. Thank you, Renata, for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Tatiana. You know that I'm an old friend of Disruption Lab, and I love what you do and your work getting closer to different communities, the challenges that we find in the digital and also in the democracy space. So to tell you who I am, I'm a human rights and technology lawyer. And I will say that I'm working on two spheres. My professional sphere, I head an organization called Ciudadanía Inteligente. And we, among other two organizations, we are leading the efforts to bring awareness and create a multinational platform of whistleblowing in Latin America. That platform is already launched. It's called LATAM Leaks. And you can look at it at latamleaks.lat. Basically, what we have now, how it is started, whistleblowing in Latin America, it started with different dropping boxes in different countries. But you know, like so it started digital. It was not a very strong culture on whistleblowing in the region, because basically it's a very hostile environment to anyone raising up the voice. And Latin America has among the highest rates of murders of human rights defenders, activists, and journalists. So you can see how incompatible it was to start promoting. I think that the task of whistleblowing in the region has a completely different context of the European context until now, because we have seen that even in Europe, journalists can be tortured, murdered, or imprisoned, as Julian Assange is at the moment. But that was the idea. The idea behind LATAM Leaks was to bring together all the people, providing the technological tools to blow the whistle, and advance it, and take a step further, and do the work we need now, which is the work on policy. And the work on laws, a law reform, a comprehensive Latin America law reform to accelerate, to fast track the whistleblowing protections that we need in parallel to the journalistic protections and also the protections of human rights defenders.
Thank you, Renata. Then I would pass the word to Joseph Farrell, that is the WikiLeaks ambassador. Thank you.
Well, this is just my introduction, correct?
Yes.
So I'm a journalist. I've worked for Julian and WikiLeaks for the last 10 years. We don't ever speak about what we're working on presently, but this is a time when there's so much whistleblowing that needs to be done. And we have developed a very secure Dropbox that is infamous and, or famous, not infamous. And so I would encourage anybody who has stuff to go and visit wikileaks.org. We work in conjunction, in close collaboration with the Courage Foundation, which is there to support the legal needs and any obstacles that a whistleblower might come into in the process of their blowing the whistle. And that's very important, because so often people don't do it because they fear the repercussions. They don't quite understand the landscape. They've never done it before. They're not sure of the right routes to take. So, and what I can talk about, which I'll probably go into a bit more when I speak later, is that currently we're just fighting for the right to publish. Whilst Julian is being imprisoned and essentially tortured in a maximum security prison, which he is incarcerated for purely for his actions as a journalist. And so there's a whole campaign around that. If the United States government is successful in extraditing Julian for his work as a journalist, there will be no such thing as free speech.
Thank you. I think we can also go into this subject a bit more in depth in the second round. I then pass to Rima to introduce herself and her work at the Hermes Center.
Thank you, Tatiana. I'm Rima Srayed, and I'm project manager and outreach director at the Hermes Center for Transparency and Digital Human Rights. I'm Tunisian, but I'm currently based in Italy to work with the center. And it's basically a digital rights NGO that operates globally, developing technologies to promote civic engagement and accountability. One of the most important and relevant to this important conversation, to which we think, thanks so much, the Disruption Lab for hosting this conversation, is GlobalX. And GlobalX is an open source, free software to create secure, anonymous whistleblowing platforms, and has been developed now since 2012, used mostly by investigative journalists, human rights organizations, and anti-corruption agencies. Thank you.
Thank you, Rima. Also, I want to say, if people are interested to know a bit more about Global Leaks, Giovanni Pellerano was with us at the conference Truth Tellers in November 2016. So we have in our video channel his own presentation about Global Leaks is recorded, and I invite everybody to check. And also, it's nice to say that, Rima, you will come back with us end of May for the conference that we are organizing. We will also speak a bit more about that at the end. Now, I would like to pose some questions to you. In particular, I have a question to Renata. While speaking about the cases of whistleblowing during the pandemic, if you could tell us a bit more what is happening in Latin America and also Chile, for example, would be important to know the situation there.
Yes, yeah, so we have the two offices, one in Brazil and one in Chile, and the root of all the problems and why we need whistleblowers is because those in power are not sharing the information that we need to take the most important decisions in our life. And I think that in our generation, never before we felt that urgency, that need, that vital need of having access to accurate information than now. The information about how sick you can get, how prepared is your government to respond to a crisis? How aware is the people on very basic things is not being provided to citizens in Latin America, and concretely is not being provided to citizens in Chile. The information is among the most incomplete informations that people have had access to. And it is a series of contradictory messages from the authorities, contradictory actions as well, with partial lockdowns in some places, but open for business in others, with no clarity on how resources are allocated, and with a lot of abuse of power, which often happens in highly unequal societies like Chile, with the private sector. Those who can afford it live in a different sphere and different risk than those who cannot. So in this balance of power and haves and have-nots, whistleblowing comes as a key piece to rebalance this power that citizens have been taking away from them. And it can come from different places, It can come from the person working at the airport and seeing how how the movement and the actions by the operations do not reflect what the authorities are saying. Or it can come from someone who is seeing that public airplanes are being used to transport private people to get a speedy access to health services while other rural inhabitants get neglected. We haven't seen specific cases of whistleblowing. What we saw was a very unfortunate case of a publication publishing a leak of information that was in custody from of the authorities, and then it was published with a lot of negligence, revealing sensitive data of And then you see the intersection with privacy, sensitive data of people affected by COVID. So, and then a whole debate unfolded in Chile on these revelations, because the lack of access to adequate information from the government triggered a leak that was not necessarily, that was actually very, 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 very complicated to deal with. And I imagine that was a very hard decision to publish for the journalist. While at the same time, and it's a point that in addition to that I want to make, yes, a lot of sensitive information will be published. A lot of complicated information and a lot of argument. We will hear during this crisis a lot of arguments on national security, a lot of arguments on social stability. But the truth is that we as citizens are expecting higher standards of proactive transparency from governments and higher standards in the custody of the sensitive information that citizens are, that they have access to, because citizens are part of the, they are providing the health services and so on. So I hear a lot of, that a lot of exceptions apply during this crisis. Transparency should not be sacrificed during a crisis. On the contrary, I think that higher levels of transparency should apply, and higher levels of responsibility from authorities and the information that they provide should apply. And also constant information should be, if they want to avoid a storm of leaks, constant information should be provided to the population. Very briefly, I know that I have extended a lot in this response, but it's important to compare two different problems. Problem of Chile, not enough information. Problem of Brazil, misleading information by the president, by the authorities. We all have seen what's going on with Donald Trump in the US. Jair Bolsonaro is 10 times worse. The level of, he has been reckless in his declarations. He has been irresponsible in his actions. And I expect as well, I mean, I hope that we will see people coming forward, whistleblowers coming forward, because it is a tragedy. It is one of the countries most affected by COVID. And of course, those affected are, if you apply the analysis with an intersectional lenses, those Afro-descendants who are poor, who have been marginalized and punished by the system of Bolsonaro during this very tragic time, are those affected by the illness. And journalists are operating in a very hostile environment, and it has been very difficult to provide the population with the right information if the president is saying something and the press is saying a completely different thing, and science abroad is saying another set of things. So big challenges ahead, and a huge task of accountability ahead, both in Chile and in Brazil and in Latin America, because what will come after this, it will be a lot of work for us in the transparency and accountability and whistleblowing and freedom of the press space. Because on top of all of this, a lot of decrees have been passed by parliaments restricting even more the right to report, the right to publish, and the right of access to information. So that's, in general, in a word, a mess.
Thank you, Renata. I also think that, of course, the situation now is even more complicated because many counties have declared the state of the exception, and so they can also introduce new form of measures. So we were discussing here the mm-hmm. Disruptive Friday, also 2 weeks ago, what is happening in Poland and Hungary. So I think we have also to consider this form of repression that is touching the civil society. And for these, whistleblowers are very important. Then I would pass to Joseph to speak about the situation in the UK, to know if there are important whistleblower cases there. Another question also that is important to pose is related to the persecution of whistleblowers. For example, in the case of Assange, the fact that he is in prison and the infection rate is very high. How is the situation there? We have also to consider the people that in the lockdown are suffering because they have no possibility to go anywhere else. And we have been also witnessing a lot of riots in prison by many people worldwide. So this is also another element that we have to consider, how to protect the people that don't have any freedom at the moment.
Yeah, so there is clearly no question that there is a lot of whistleblowing that needs to be done on this topic, especially, well, not especially, but also in the UK. I was reading about Eileen Chubb, who has a whistleblower line called Compassion and Care. And I think in this period they've had, it's whistleblowing that relates to medical facilities, but in this period alone, they've had over 170 cases. But the problem that comes in this situation is, and it Renata dealt with it somewhat, is that there's so much censorship that's going on during this pandemic, censorship and control. And in this desperate and dire situation, we found ourselves in a quote unquote situation that it's almost reasonable that the social change happens. I think in years to come, we'll discover that it wasn't reasonable, but it was in fact treasonable. But the term can, that allowing for that social change, we're more disposed to it because the situation is dire. And that social change could also be termed social control. So we know that in times of crises, exceptional measures are normalized. It becomes accepted and we accept them more readily ourselves. And if you look at the term crisis itself, it's Greek for a turning point. And so the turning point is happening both for the individual, but also for the government. They're using it as a turning point. And the one good thing, if you like, is that we are all in this position together. So it's a very leveling ground. And that also allows for more people to come together as we've come together now and talk about it because we're all in the same position. And we're also all subject to the information that we receive, and that information is being clamped down on. Now, in the UK, you see basically just a constant call to support Boris Johnson, and yet the UK has one of the highest, worst regional death rates due to the virus, so much so that it is very rare to find a country comparative graph. And actually, just before this talk, I decided to do a very cursory search on Google for the UK graph of COVID cases compared to others. And throughout the UK media, the only graphs I could come across were from March and April. So it seems that it's almost like the only path to the truth is via the official government advice. And, you know, when has that ever been an idea that is genuinely and generally subscribed to? Some of their advice, which I don't disagree with, is, of course, to maintain social distancing. However, they're pushing the boundaries of that idea and are allowing for it to penetrate other spheres of our lives. So there's now a push to create digital distancing, which in turn creates a social distancing of ideas. And we see this in WhatsApp, where you can only forward a message to an individual person. You can't send it to a lot of people. So that is us allowing for Facebook, who owns WhatsApp, to control just how much our ideas get out to other people. You know, we're talking about a control that is enveloping 2 billion people. And also in the UK, in fact, they've gone so far as to engage with big organizations such as Amazon, Microsoft, and Palantir to use NHS patient data to help combat the virus with data analytics. Now, Palantir is a known CIA contractor. So here we are willingly giving our data over to to the CIA. And sure, in the small print, it says things like the data will only be used for A, B, or C. But since when has the CIA, you know, the CIA is an organization that thrives through murder and assassination. It's not necessarily something they're going to adhere to. The small print says that they will destroy or delete it when the virus is over. And, you know, here we see how words get manipulated. We see when the virus is over, well, when is it going to be over? It's never going to be over. Even if we get it under control, it's not going to be over. You know, the way organizations and governments twist words, enhanced interrogation techniques. It's just another way of saying torture. And so I think this should be a very strong wake-up call for all of us. We, as I've said before, we're all in the same boat. And when did the sharing of ideas become a thing that needed to be controlled? And they do it in the name of regulating or suppressing false information or fake news. But that leads to a one-dimensional view. And the only thing that can really help that is robust, strong scientific journalism. You know, with scientific journalism present, it is very difficult for fake news to, excuse the pun, go viral. It's difficult for it to exist because, and the other benefit of having something, if you can call it a benefit of fake news, its mere existence makes, or should at least make, people question the story they're reading. And if scientific journalism is present, then it doesn't matter if you don't quite believe what you're reading. You can go and look at the backstory and everything that is related to that story. And that's essentially what the WikiLeaks model was. It has always been about scientific journalism. You know, you don't have to believe what we put out, because you can go and read everything that is the basis for what we have put out. And I suppose we're lucky in that, and I am going to take a lot of credit, that we have seen what is called the WikiLeaksization of the media in many places. And that's not my term. That's actually Jack Goldsmith's term, who's a law professor and previous assistant attorney general. And we've seen it just from listening to the introductions of Global Leaks, LATAM Leaks, WikiLeaks. That community is what will save us. And, you know, if wrongful information, if lies can lead us into wars where there are countless hundreds of thousands of innocent people who die as a result of it, then the converse is true, and that true information can save us. And we saw that in, for example, the many of our publications, but with the Iraq publications. Am I still on, or have I lost signal?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, so with the WikiLeaks publications, we saw how it resulted in there being in the US not occupying it. I'm trying to think. I always tend to lose my train of thought at some point.
I mean, maybe you can answer me to the second part, because then we have to pass to Rima, in which I was asking you about the discourse of the infection rates in prison, because we have also to say that in May there was supposed to be the trial of Julian, but now has been postponed. But of course, this makes the situation even more difficult because he's in prison for a longer time. So if you can also tell us
something. Yeah, so the government was talking about a release, controlled release scheme, because it is impossible to maintain social distancing in a prison. The prisons are overcrowded. Julian, for example, has not been able to have any calls with his legal team, because in order for him to be present at court via video conferencing or for him to speak to his lawyers, he has to traverse the entirety of the prison and then sit in a waiting room, which is common to all the prisoners who are speaking to their lawyers for, you know, it can be an hour, 2 hours. And so he's had legal advice, medical advice, sorry, not to actually do that. And with Julian in particular, I know you want a broader picture, but it's useful to focus on an individual. He had already spent 7 years in arbitrary detention, which had he had a pre-existing lung condition. 7 years of detainment made that, exacerbated it. And we put in a request for bail so that he could be at least in a secure location. That was denied. You know, all the prisoners, they're just sitting ducks. So the government has started to release, they said that they would release 4,000 prisoners, which I think is about 5% of the population. But to date, they've only released something like 15 pregnant women and a few others who happened to be on the point of being released anyway. And they've refused to release people who are on remand. And if you are on remand, it means you haven't been convicted. So we're in this dystopian situation where they say you have to have been proven guilty beyond reasonable doubt before we will release you from prison. You know, the people who haven't been even had their trial don't get to go. And it's, as I said in the introduction, the question is, Julian is there purely for his publications in relation to the Iraq and Afghan war logs, his publications about the obscenities of the US foreign policy and the Guantanamo files. He's there for the same reasons that he received all the journalistic awards. I think I've probably reached my time max.
Thank you. I think we can also go on further with the question of the public in going in depth on certain subjects, but now I want to pass to Rima, and I would ask her to tell us a bit more about the situation in the MENA region. She has been operating a lot in Tunisia as well. So can you tell us something about the freedom, the press freedom there? What is the situation for whistleblowers in the crisis in that specific region?
Thank you, Tatiana. And I would like to add on what Renata and Joseph said. In a context where, frankly, what's happening in the MENA region is a part of a global response to the crisis, where we had a lot of panic and fear, creating a certain rhetoric by government, what we can call a war rhetoric in this health crisis, antagonizing critics. And in these months, it has been very difficult for journalists to work. And here I would like also to mention freelance journalists all over the world. I see it in Italy, but in many other countries where their livelihoods has been put at risk with all these draconian measures. Even if journalists are considered essential workers, they are actually unable to work in many countries without the what they call like the journalist card. Journalists, but also human rights defenders in the MENA region, I can mention Algeria or Egypt, where we have seen some kind of like a use of this context where there is a lot of panic and the logic of priority where like health is everything, is the center of everything. And we've seen authorities crack down on human rights activists and arrest bloggers. We've seen also parliaments in the MENA region working on some emergency laws with the pretext of fighting fake news, but written in a way that absolutely endangers freedom of expression. And for us at the Hermes Center, we care about whistleblowers and protecting whistleblowers, but all the ecosystem around it, the lawyers and the journalists, and all those who contribute to speaking truth to power. And we have been also part of the letter that you mentioned, signed the letter that you mentioned, Tatiana, but also there is a lot of of work that the civil society is doing to denounce the deployment of massive surveillance and the response, the government response that is not based on the respect of fundamental rights. I wanted to mention that we would like to support more in this time where we need a lot of accountability and to understand what happened and like the truth about the spread of the disease. We have a small granted program that I'm managing for the Urban Center for Transparency and Digital Human Rights called the Digital Whistleblowing Fund. And we're about to roll out a new round for granting five grassroots organizations support technical and financial to create their own whistleblowing solutions. GlobalX, we believe in empowering local communities in having these tools, as Joseph mentioned, because of all the repercussions, the threats that whistleblowers risk, and especially at this time, it's important to for human rights organizations and investigative media platforms to provide a secure tool where sources and whistleblowers can share the information without having to reveal their identity. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we could go soon to the rounds with the audience question, but first I have a question for all of you, just also to imagine something a bit concrete in the discussion. Perhaps I could also go back to Renata to ask going back to the discourse of the letter that was advocating for whistleblowing protection. How can we actually guarantee this whistleblowing protection in legal and political terms during this crisis? Would important to know a bit more on measures that need to be implemented and what you are doing at the moment. Rima, you just to say. I wanted to ask Renata if she can say a bit more on in which way they are working on this.
You know, I will make a comparison that might sound harsh. I think that with whistleblowers happens the same as with healthcare workers. You hear people clapping, you know, and saying, great whistleblowers, go whistleblowers, stand up and show the truth to the world. And then we leave them completely alone and completely and without the protections they need. And I have seen the lives of so many people destroyed because it is there's no match in our societies. There's no match of the discourse of whistleblowing protection and the actions our community takes to really protect them. We can expect and we are working towards in Europe especially to have a comprehensive whistleblower protection, which will be distributed not only in one institution, but an ecosystem of institutions across all the European Union and beyond. It involves laws and policies, and I will say that it's the most advanced frame in the world to make it happen. But that's just one element. And while it happens, we need to develop a level of commitment and real solidarity that transcends what a policy or a law can do. And I think that what happens, and Joseph was explaining it brilliantly, is it also happens this social distancing, digital distancing and social distancing when someone comes out and reveals the truth. I have seen so many cases of people, when I was collaborating with the Courage Foundation, and all the time I have seen with WikiLeaks, I have seen that all these courageous, all this clapping and courageous discourses shy away when the things get really complicated. We saw it with Edward Snowden. We saw it with Chelsea Manning. Chelsea Manning, it took 10 years to Amnesty International to finally, you know, like be bold and loud on the issue of Chelsea Manning. They only now they're starting to support the whistleblower in the US, reality winner. It is a long time, especially if you're alone in a cell in prison, to activate the systems of solidarity. And my work is right now focused in Latin America on exploring which institutions can provide rapid response, not only to the whistleblowers, but to their families. And it should be a mechanism, a similar mechanism of the mechanisms that have been developed over the last decade to protect journalists in the region, like fellowships to take them out of the country quickly, support, economic support, psychological support for them and their families, matching them with responsible institutions that will actually publish what they're revealing. It takes a community to protect whistleblowers, but the benefit that, and is it, there has been a fetishization, it has been this obsession on just the day when the lights are on and when the big revelation, and there's very little follow-up actually, even in the stories. And publishers, at the same time, courageous publishers and courageous whistleblowers are facing a lot of threats. We have seen it with the case of Julian Assange. We have seen it with the case of Glenn Greenwald in Brazil, with all the revelations on Sergio Moro and Jair Bolsonaro. We have seen it everywhere. And instead of ostracizing them, we need to support them as we can. If we can support independent media with a donation, or WikiLeaks with a donation, if we can support an invitation, your family can stay in my living room one night if they need protection. Actions are better than clapping, are better than words. And a chain of solidarity actions can actually save lives and improve our democratic ecosystem. Make it more regular. Make it an activity that is not so costly to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say it's time to ask for the question of the public, and of course I would also ask by answer to that maybe to give a comment to the what Renata just said. So we take all the things together. Elena here from behind the curtains to tell us how it's going with the chat of the public. Are there any questions?
Hello, can you hear me? Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, today the chat is a bit quiet, but I think it's very essential, these few questions that we have. So I will just read it to you now, and you can pick up. They're mostly addressed. So the first mm-hmm. one is a question to Renata, but actually more of a clarification. Does anyone know the specific articles? Can you mention the specific articles in Chile that you were referencing, or maybe we can do that later in the chat, or if you could refer to a certain link. So there is one question for Rima, but also for others, if they know, has there been any response from governments or policymakers on the letter that you signed by the NGOs for better whistleblower protection? One is an also general question to all. Is it possible to say a few words about the fundamental infrastructures available to whistleblowers at the outset of their whistleblowing activities? And beside the anonymized Dropbox, for anyone here who might not have background knowledge on the subject. And the fourth one is more like a comment or about your practice of work. I would like to hear a discussion on the topic of partners, meaning journalists, lawyers, public advocacy organizations, about the responsibility towards the individuals and the information that they receive, meaning specifically how do you decide when not to publish an information or when to redact information to protect the whistleblowers. So this is all from the questions now. I will also share it with all of you.
Okay, so I think we can start first with Renata, because there was something very specific. And then we can go to Rima about the letter and if the there was any response. Also, everybody is asked to that. So maybe we can start with these two. Renata, we cannot hear you.
Sorry, I was muted. It was a leak from the Ministry of Health, and it was actually we have in Chile there's a very strong privacy and data protection law, and the publication was called Interferencia. Interferencia in Chile was the news outlet publishing the sensitive data. And as I was saying, it is important to highlight the negligence of the Ministry of Health on protecting those data. That's I will say that it is often our first impulse to go after the journalists. But in all these years, defending the right to publish, I really encourage people to look at he or she who collects the data has the duty to protect it, especially if it's sensitive data. If it is the state, that responsibility is even higher. So Interferencia is the news outlet, and the Ministry of Health was the negligent one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then the second question was for Rima. And also for the others, so if there have been any response from government or policymakers on the letter that is signed by so many NGOs for whistleblower protection?
Regarding the letter, I'm not aware of any official responses, but I wanted to answer the question about any other resources aside from the technology. And as Renata very eloquently explained, the importance of a full ecosystem providing all kinds of support, from psychological, financial, legal support to whistleblowers, I would like to remind some of the elements in our community. As civil society in different countries worldwide, there are our partners, Transparency International, and their special ALACs, or like centers for advice to whistleblowers, which don't exist in every country, unfortunately, in the world, but in many countries worldwide. You can, like in Italy, like in Tunisia, there is iWatch. Whistleblowers can get in touch and to get some support from the start. And it's really important to do it from the start, because the moment the information is out, like the cycle of hell starts. And also I wanted to recall our partner and actually member of the WIN, which is like Whistleblower International Network. I really highly recommend that to get in touch, because it's like one place where so many organizations, but not only like Transparency International, but anti-corruption NGOs and whistleblowers organizations that specialize in support for whistleblowers. Thank you.
And Joseph, would you like to add something on this?
Yeah, well, to the third question about when to publish or when not to publish. I can speak to that. You know, well, WikiLeaks itself has a very specific, detailed, outlined editorial policy. We'll publish things that are in the public interest, that have political or diplomatic importance or historical importance, that have been censored or never previously published before. There was a question about in that was how to protect the source. Now, Renata gave a very accurate description of what happens with whistleblowers, but there's a much lighter and easier way that people can do it, and that is actually to remain anonymous. You know, the job of the publisher is to work out, is the information we are receiving accurate? Is it true? And should it be published? Who the source is quite irrelevant. And so that's the point of keeping it an anonymous Dropbox, so that somebody can do something huge like that and not face repercussion, but they have to keep quiet. They can't go telling people that they've done it. And that was unfortunately where, you know, Chelsea Manning exposed herself. It didn't happen through the Dropbox system. But there was another question in there, which was even if we receive stuff from individuals and it's anonymous, quite often, and organizations and think tanks do this, and people need to be aware of it, but it's hard to be aware. Quite often, there will be identifying data in the information that you submit. And so that's something when we publish, we spend ages cleaning that up. Sometimes it could be a document from a think tank in Rio, and they were having a similar think tank somewhere else, and the ones in Rio all had an extra full stop on, so that if it ever got leaked, they could actually determine which group or which were the people that were where the source had come from. But that's usually so that they can go and take revenge, for want of better words. So that a lot of work goes into cleaning up documents, so that when they are published, all the information is true and accurate, but nothing is identifiable.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was also very important the point that Renata was saying at the beginning, the one about transparency, especially related to what is happening at the moment, because we are also witnessing a lot of misinformation, especially related to medical records, information on the health system, and so on. So I also believe that we need two different paths that go along about security and also the protection of whistleblowers by having the right infrastructure. But at the same time, we also need to guarantee transparency to be able to have access to the data that matter, and that also allowed us to understand what are the reliable sources and what is the correct information that needs to be spread. And this is also related to the discourse of journalism, to literacy that Joseph was also speaking about. Rima, for example, would you like to add something more about the discourse of transparency and also the current misinformation that we are experiencing?
Thank you, Tatiana. Sure. A lot of the problems exactly that we're having are not, like, we talk a lot about fake news, but we're talking a lot less about what we know about the different measures that the governments are taking, including the tracing apps and the technology used and the data, what is the data that is being collected and how is it being collected? In Italy, I wanted to mention the example how the Hermes Center actually wrote the letter to the presidents of regions to ask for more transparency about all data related to COVID, because even in countries like in the European Union, we're still having issues with sharing, like the authorities and governments are sharing very minimal information without much detail that would allow researchers and scientists and journalists to analyze and create all of this information that is missing. I will paste it in the chat. Thank you, Tatiana, and everyone. Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to point out that the 12th of August, we will have an event, hopefully outdoor, in which we will show the film Never Whistle Alone, that is also about Italian whistleblowing and anti-corruption. So I take the opportunity to mention that, because also what is happening in Italy at the moment in terms of freedom of speech or transparency is something that needs also to be considered in our discussion. I think we are basically at the end. I just would like to ask the three of you if you have a final comment, and then we can call Lieke to announce what is happening next. But first, I want you to have the final word.
The final word is collaboration to me. We found a lot of inspiration on technical partners like WikiLeaks and GlobalLeaks, publishing partners, also in, all the activists and policymakers struggling to pass the EU directive on whistleblowing. And it is a model, you know, a model of collaboration and constant solidarity. We have a fight ahead, and the fight that we have ahead is to impede the extradition of Julian Assange next September, because that's a model case that can affect whistleblowing globally forever. If both the publisher and the whistleblower are punished with torture, that's a very, very bad message that we are sending to all over the world. So it is a great opportunity to unite in a global struggle and to pass the laws that will protect whistleblowers and journalists adequately as we face these big challenges ahead of us, with secrecy at its core and whistleblowing as the medicine to fix it.
Thank you, Renata. Then I would ask Joseph to say his own feedback.
Well, Renata basically said everything I would have said. Mostly. She did a very good job there. But I think solidarity is definitely a very good word. You have to look out for each other. Whistleblowing and publishing are symbiotic. One doesn't live without the other. And as she said, Julian's case, it's not about Julian. Everyone needs to remember it's not about Julian. That case is about the right to publish. And if they get him, then there's nothing to stop any country in the world requesting the extradition from any other person anywhere in the world if they just publish something that they don't find particularly favorable. So solidarity, unite, and write everybody. It's a European issue as much as it is a UK issue. Everyone should be writing to their members of parliament to stop this. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. And Rima, you want to conclude?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Tatiana. I wouldn't have said it also better than Renata. Solidarity is here the key word for us as civil society, and attention, like not losing focus, like the attention on what's happening right now, threatening freedom of expression, and how it's important for technology and law and all the elements of civil society to be united in all these diverse communities and be connected and know each other's stories and what's happening. This is really, really important. Thank you.
Thank you, Rima. So now I pass to Lieke Plucher, that is directed with me the Disruption Network Club, and she will also introduce what is happening soon for a conference that we organize in cooperation National, speaking about transparency. Lieke, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you. So yeah, normally at the end of the Disruptive Fridays, we organize the next Disruptive Fridays, but now we're actually going to organize something even better because we have our conference coming up on the 29th and the 30th of May, so in 2 weeks. And the conference is called Evicted by Greed, Global Finance, Housing and Resistance. And it will consist of a 2-day program of panels and keynotes with experts and activists from around the world. And we will be talking about how speculators and investors are using loopholes to disrupt the housing market. And also, of course, what we can do about this. So we're very happy to have also Rima with us again for the conference. And she will be the moderator of the panel Foggy Properties and Golden Sands, Money Laundering in London and Dubai. And in this panel, we will have Sam Leon of Global Witness and Karina Shedrovsky of the OCCRP Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. And they will be speaking about how money laundering and organized crime and corruption are influencing real estate, and especially addressing the context of London and Dubai. And yeah, there's a lot more on the program. I cannot go, of course, through everything now because we have limited time. But I would also still like to mention that we will have a keynote on the first day by Christoph Trautvetter, who's a public policy expert working on real estate ownership in Berlin. And he just published this week a study about the anonymous real estate owners in Berlin. It was published by the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, and it was quite shocking that they found there's actually a lot of anonymity about this real estate investors, and we need definitely a lot more transparency. So he will be talking about this, and we also have somebody speaking about the content in Barcelona. This will be Manuel Gabara de Sus. So this will be one of the keynotes. And yeah, if you want to check the full program, of course, you can see it on our website. And yeah, the conference will be via live streaming, just as the event today. And there's no need to register. It will be free to attend. And of course, yeah, we hope to see also many of you there. And yeah, that's it for the announcement.
And thank you, Lieke. I also take the opportunity that was moderating the chat today. And so a final thanks to all of you, Renata, Joseph, and Rima. And I want to say everybody that will be stored on our website, so people can watch it again there and also on YouTube. So thank you so much, all of you. And we will keep the fight ongoing. Thank you.